This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Enemy at the Gates, The Battle for Stalingrad. Written by William Craig. Narrated by David Baker. To my wife Eleanor, whom I cherish. Prologue. When I was a child, I discovered an exciting fantasy world in the pages of history books. At 7, I marched to the walls of Jerusalem beside the Crusaders. At 9, I memorized Alfred Lord Tennyson's glorious paean to the immortal men of the Light Brigade as they charged at Balaclava. 2 years later, uprooted from familiar surroundings when my family moved to another city, I discovered a kindred spirit in the lonely figure of Napoleon Bonaparte as he languished in exile on St. Helena Island. The bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, added a new dimension to my interest in historical figures and events. My own relatives were plunged into the global conflict, and I followed their exploits with a daily diary of World War II. As the self-ordained Boswell to the Allied forces, I neglected my Latin declensions to record the ominous details about Wake, Guam, Bataan, and Corregidor. On entering the 8th grade in the fall of 1942, I became an amateur cartographer, drawing meticulous maps of places like Guadalcanal and New Guinea, even a city called Stalingrad, deep inside Russia. Because of my passionate interest in Napoleon, because I knew of the rout of his Grande Armée on the vast snow-covered plains of Tsarist Russia, I quickly developed an interest in the German attempt to conquer the Soviet Union. It occurred to me that the same fate might await the Nazi panzers as they moved resolutely into the heartland of the USSR. During October and November of 1942, I spent more and more time away from my studies to read everything I could find about this Soviet city on the edge of Asia. The reports told of fighting in sewers, cellars, office buildings, and I tried desperately to imagine such horrible moments in men's lives. For a 13-year-old boy brought up in a peaceful land, such images were difficult to conjure. In February 1943, the German Sixth Army surrendered, and our newspapers carried pictures of the astonishing Russian victory. One particular wire photo of captured Field Marshal Friedrich von Paulus caught my attention. His face was deeply lined. His eyes spoke of nightmares he had witnessed. This once proud German officer was now a broken man. The memory of that picture remained with me over the years. During the next quarter century, an avalanche of books spewed forth from both Soviet and German presses about Stalingrad. Some were personal narratives, others historical treatises. The Russians wrote proudly of their incredible victory. Frequently, however, they distorted facts in order to conform to political realities. Stalin's name disappeared from accounts of the battle. So did those of Khrushchev, Malenkov, and Marshal Georgi Zhukov. Thus, the Russian side of the story was shrouded by official secrecy. The telling of the story from the German side suffered a different distortion. Few German authors examined the myriad complexities that led to the loss of Sixth Army at Stalingrad, nor could they, since they were denied access to Russian sources, and the memoirs of the German generals who participated in the battle were filled with controversial statements, personal vilification, and censure. Furthermore, the Germans never gave credit to the Red Army for its dogged defense of Stalingrad and brilliant counterattack that defeated what, until then, had been the finest army in the world. By now, I had become an author and historian, and, still captivated by that picture of a beaten Paulus, I embarked on a personal investigation of what had happened at Stalingrad. To be successful in this venture, I had to do what no one had done before: study the official records of both the Russian and Axis forces engaged in the conflict, visit the battlefield and walk the ground for which so many men had died, locate survivors of the battle, Russians, Germans, Italians, Romanians, Hungarians, and get their eyewitness accounts, their diaries, photographs, and letters. It was not an easy task. First, I met with Ernst von Paulus, the field marshal's only surviving son, at Viersen in West Germany. Looking strikingly like his father, Ernst spoke for hours about the man who had endured so much. The loss of his entire army, his years of captivity in the Soviet Union, the twilight of a broken life in Dresden, where Paulus spent his last days composing rebuttals to those critics blaming him for the tragedy at Stalingrad. Then I went to Stalingrad, the city that had destroyed Paulus's career and reputation. A casual visitor there finds that Stalingrad is once again an industrial giant in the Soviet Union. Its broad boulevards are rimmed with banks of flowers. Sparkling white apartment houses form miles of comfortable oases in a sea of busy factories and workshops. The city's inhabitants move energetically along downtown streets. At one intersection, a crowd gathers around a new sedan to admire it. At night, couples stroll the Volga embankment and watch the lights of passing steamers and barges. In so peaceful a setting, it is almost impossible to imagine that two nations fought a titanic battle here only 30 years ago. Evidence of that cruel struggle is sparse. At a grain elevator, an irregular line of bullet holes can be seen across the concrete face of the silos. On the wall of the bustling Univermag department store, a plaque notes that the German 6th Army surrendered there in 1943. Further north, on Solichnaya Street, a television antenna sprouts up from an apartment house where another sign describes a 58-day struggle for the building during the fall of 1942. As I stood there reading it, children ran across a grassy courtyard that once had been filled with mines and dead soldiers. At the small Volgograd Defense Museum near the main railroad station, justifiably proud officials showed me memorabilia of the conflict, the tattered and bullet-riddled great coat of a Red Army officer, hundreds of red, white, and black flags displaying the swastika that had been taken from famous German units, guns, official orders, captured diaries, and letters. On all the walls were brightly painted dioramas of battle scenes. But only at Mamive Hill, rising from the center of the city, can one begin to understand the enormity of what really happened there. As I walked the 336 feet to its summit, I passed through a forest of sculptured tableaus recalling the Russian triumph. A figure of General Vasily Ivanovich Chuikov, the one man who could be termed the savior of Stalingrad. A woman holding tight to a dying boy. Men firing their weapons at enemies trying to drive them into the Volga. At the top of Mamaev, I gazed upward in amazement at a 170-foot-high statue of Mother Russia. A cape flies back from her shoulders, and her right hand brandishes a sword. The face is contorted as she exhorts her countrymen to victory. In a circular rotunda at her feet is a mass grave containing the mortal remains of 10,000 of her sons gathered together from the battlefield. Their names have been inscribed on the rotunda's walls. Funereal music sounds constantly in the stillness. From the middle of a concrete slab covering their resting place, a giant carved arm thrusts defiantly upward. In its clenched fist, a gleaming torch pierces the gloom. From a winding ramp, visitors gaze down onto the tomb. No one speaks. The hush of death follows them out into the brilliant sunlight, where Stalingrad seethes with renewed life. The trenches have been filled in. Barbed wire has disappeared from the hillside. All the rusted tanks and guns have been removed. Even German grave markers have been pulled from the earth. Almost every physical scar of that terrible war has been erased. But the mental scars remain, and around the world, men and women who were at Stalingrad in 1942 still flinch at the memories of those awful days. There is the Stalingrad factory worker whose eyes narrow in hatred as he recalls enemy planes machine-gunning civilians on a crowded Volga pier. A former Soviet officer who speaks haltingly as he describes the terrible cries of his men after they had been ambushed and slaughtered in the fields west of Stalingrad. A Russian emigre in Haifa, Israel, who sobs his grief at the memory of a baby smashed against a wall by drunken German soldiers. In an opulently furnished home in Rome, an eminent Italian surgeon shudders as he explains the various stages of cannibalism that occurred in the prison camps of Siberia after the battle ended. His wife listens in horrified fascination as the doctor recalls that the most sophisticated cannibals ignored corpses more than a day old. They preferred the warm blood of freshly killed soldiers. A Russian woman, now the wife of a prominent American musician, has only one searing recollection. 18 months after the fighting ended, when her refugee train stopped at Stalingrad, the stench of thousands upon thousands of corpses still lying in the rubble made her want to vomit. It is the same with the Germans. In a suburb of Hamburg, when a strapping Luftwaffe officer unlocks bitter images of beatings by Soviet prison guards, he suddenly breaks down completely and begs me not to question him further. In Cologne, a woman who has been waiting 27 years for the return of her husband, reported missing in action, asks me a question. Her eyes glassy with tears, she says, "Do you think I should go to Stalingrad and look for him?" I think of her unbelievable devotion to the memory of a man long since written off as a casualty by government archivists, and can only shake my head numbly and say, "No, I don't think it would help." She had known what my answer would be. Smiling bravely, she rose and made tea for the two of us. The catalog of bitter memories increased in scope as I met with hundreds of men and women who survived the Holocaust of Stalingrad. I was deeply upset by what they told me, and I had to remind myself time and again that I had to listen to these tales of horror because the stories were vital to a valid reconstruction of the conflict. Most appalling was the growing realization, formed by statistics I uncovered, that the battle was the greatest military bloodbath in recorded history. Well over 1 million men and women died because of Stalingrad, a number far surpassing the previous records of dead at the First Battle of the Somme and Verdun in 1916. The toll breaks down as follows. Conversations with official Russian sources on a not-for-attribution basis, and it must be remembered that the Russians have never officially admitted their losses in World War II, put the loss of Red Army soldiers at Stalingrad at 750,000 killed, wounded, or missing in action. The Germans lost almost 400,000 men. The Italians lost more than 130,000 men out of their 200,000-man army. The Hungarians lost approximately 120,000 men. The Romanians also lost approximately 200,000 men around Stalingrad. As for the civilian population of the city, a pre-war census listed more than 500,000 people prior to the outbreak of World War II. This number increased as a flood of refugees poured into the city from other areas of Russia that were in danger of being overrun by the Germans. A portion of Stalingrad's citizens were evacuated prior to the first German attack, but 40,000 civilians were known to have died in the first 2 days of bombing in the city. No one knows how many died on the barricades, or in the anti-tank ditches, or in the surrounding steppes. Official records show only one stark fact. After the battle ended, a census found only 1,515 people who had lived in Stalingrad in 1942. As these grim statistics emerged, I began asking the survivors the most important questions of all. What was the significance of the battle? In 1944, General Charles de Gaulle visited Stalingrad and walked past the still uncleared wreckage. Later, at a reception in Moscow, a correspondent asked him his impressions of the scene. "Ah, Stalingrad, c'est tout de même un peuple formidable, un très grand peuple," the Free French leader said. The correspondent agreed. "Ah oui, les Russes," de Gaulle interrupted impatiently. "Mais non, je ne parle pas des Russes, je parle des Allemands. Tout de même, avoir poussé jusque-là." That they should have come so far. Anyone with an understanding of military problems must agree with de Gaulle that the Germans had been able to cross more than 1,000 miles of southern Russia to reach the banks of the Volga River was an incredible achievement, that the Russians held them at Stalingrad when almost every Allied strategist thought the Soviet Union was on the verge of collapse, is equally extraordinary. Battered for more than a year by the Nazi juggernaut, most soldiers in the Soviet army had become convinced the Germans were unbeatable. Thousands of them streamed into enemy lines to ask for succor. Thousands more bolted from the front lines and ran away. In unoccupied Russia, the civilian population fell victim to the same despair. With millions dead or under German control, with food, clothing, and shelter in increasingly short supply, the majority of the Russian people had begun to doubt their leadership and their armies. The surprising victory over the German Sixth Army at Stalingrad changed that negative attitude. Psychologically buoyed by this magnificent triumph against the Nazi supermen, both civilians and military braced for the grueling tasks ahead. And though the ultimate destruction of the Third Reich would prove to be a long and costly struggle, the Russians never again doubted they would win. After Stalingrad, they moved resolutely westward, straight to Berlin, and the legacy of their arduous passage into the heartland of Germany remains with us to this day. For the Soviet Union, the path to its present role as a superpower began at the Volga River, where, as Winston Churchill described it, the hinge of fate had turned. For the Germans, Stalingrad was the single most traumatic event of the war. Never before had so many soldiers vanished without trace in the vast wilderness of an alien country. Stalingrad was a mind-paralyzing calamity to a nation that believed it was the master race. A creeping pessimism began to invade the minds of those who had chanted "Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil" at Hitler's rallies, and the myth of the Führer's genius slowly dissolved under the impact of the reality of Stalingrad. In furtive conversations, men once too timid to move against the regime began to make concrete plans to overthrow it. Stalingrad was the beginning of the end for the Third Reich. After spending 4 years intensively researching the Battle of Stalingrad from both sides of no man's land, I found that the mosaic of the story changed with the passing days, as does all history. The brilliant German offensive to the Volga paled in relation to the inspired defense of Stalingrad by the Russians. Beyond that, most gripping of all, was the gradual moral and physical disintegration of the German soldiers as they realized they were doomed. In their struggle to cope with the unthinkable lies the ultimate drama of the event. Brutality, sadism, and cowardice are undeniably prominent in the story. Jealousy, overriding ambition, and callousness to human suffering occur with shocking frequency. Man aspires to greatness, but all too often his hopes are submerged by the primitive instinct to survive at any cost. What happens is not pleasant reading. No book that deals with widespread slaughter can be. At Stalingrad, we are witnesses to monumental human tragedy. William Craig, Westport, Connecticut, November 8, 1972. Part 1. Chapter 1. Parched by the blazing sun of summer, the grassy plain of the steppe country is light brown in hue. From the vicinity of Lugansk in the west to Kazakhstan in the east, the barren tableland stretches more than 600 miles across southern Russia. Only a few rectangular patches of cultivated farmland, kolkhozy, relieve the desolation, and from them, ribbons of road run straight to the horizon. Two majestic rivers, running roughly north to south, scour the land. The erratic Don gouges a convulsive path through the city of Rostov on the Sea of Azov. Farther east, the mighty Volga bends more gently on its way to a rendezvous with the Caspian Sea at Astrakhan. Only at one place do the rivers run parallel to each other, and here they are 40 miles apart. After that brief attempt at union, they flow relentlessly on their lonely journeys to different destinations, giving but brief respite to the harsh terrain. Otherwise, the suffocating heat of the region cracks the ground and paralyzes life. It has been that way for centuries on the steppe, but on August 5, 1942, a malevolent presence intruded on the timeless scene. From the west, from the far-off Ukraine, came giant pillars of dust. The whirling clouds advanced fitfully across the prairie, slowing only for short periods before moving on toward the east and the Don River barrier. From a distance, they resembled tornadoes, those natural phenomena that plague the open areas of the earth. But these spiraling clouds hid the German Sixth Army, an elite legion dispatched by Adolf Hitler to destroy the Soviet army and the communist state led by Joseph Stalin. Its men were supremely confident. During 3 years of warfare, they had never suffered defeat. In Poland, the Sixth Army had made the word blitzkrieg, lightning war, a synonym for Nazi omnipotence. At Dunkirk, it helped cripple the British Expeditionary Force, sending the Tommies back to England without rifles or artillery. Chosen to spearhead the cross-channel invasion, the Sixth Army practiced amphibious landings until Hitler lost enthusiasm for the assault and sent it instead to Yugoslavia, which it conquered in a matter of weeks. Then, in the summer of 1941, the Sixth Army began its Russian campaign and completely mastered the enemy. It quickly liberated several million square miles of the Ukraine and attained a level of professional excellence unmatched in modern warfare. Increasingly arrogant about their successes on the battlefield, its soldiers reached the conclusion that Russland ist kaputt. This conviction was buttressed by propaganda emanating from the Führerhauptquartier, field headquarters of the OKW. For with the unleashing in late June 1942 of Operation Blue, the knockout blow, Adolf Hitler had promised his soldiers an end to the war. Most Germans on the steppe agreed with their Führer's prophecies of triumph, especially when they noted the slackening resistance of the Red Army. Now, on this stifling August morning, the Sixth Army prepared to spring another trap. Two battered Soviet armies, the 1st Tank and the 62nd Infantry, lay penned up against the cliffs that dominate the western bank of the Don. Fingers of steel had already reached out on either side of the Russians. Packs of German Mark III and Mark IV tanks, coated with dust, roamed the land. From hundreds of turrets, tank commanders issued curt orders to gunners who swiveled their weapons around to fire on targets of opportunity. Terrified Russian soldiers, lacking faith in their officers and in the Red Army itself, rushed to join a swelling throng of deserters. The Germans herded them into ragged columns that marched west, away from the sounds of war. The Russians were happy. Capture meant they had survived. The Germans had little time to care for their prisoners. In regimental and divisional command posts, senior officers drew new lines on maps, wrote out new directives, and gave them to couriers who gunned their motorcycles past jammed lines of trucks, moving men and supplies ever closer to the Don River. Inside the transports, infantrymen tied handkerchiefs over their faces to ward off the clouds of dirt that engulfed them. Their gray-green uniforms were coated with steppe soil. Their eyes were bloodshot. They were miserable, but since they were winning, morale was high. Strident marching songs drifted out from the lorries as the motorcyclists roared by. When the couriers reached the main line of resistance, they handed messages to weary battalion and company commanders, some of whom had not rested for more than 30 days. Their appearance reflected the strain of constant combat. Faces were pinched, their once neat uniforms stuck to their bodies and held the accumulated grime of the steppe. Helmets were a monstrous hindrance, a magnet for the sun that beat on them and sent perspiration pouring down inside their collars. Still, the officers shrugged off the discomfort and shouted new commands to their bedraggled men. The Lancers stubbed out cigarettes, shouldered rifles and machine pistols, and fell into the inevitable columns pointing east, always east, into the heartland of the Soviet Union. Contrary to popular belief at the time, German armies were far from total mechanization. In 6th Army alone, more than 25,000 horses moved guns and supplies. They were everywhere. Huge Belgian draft horses, small Russian pongies, not much bigger than donkeys, and native to the steppe. Their flanks heaved from exertion, and their eyes rolled as they bucked in fear at sudden explosions. The marching soldiers stepped in the manure and cursed violently at this additional affront to their sensibilities. But they marched on and quickly reached the edge of no man's land, where burned and gutted tanks stood mute, their treads twisted crazily, and gun barrels snapped off. Amidst this desolation, the troops dug shallow foxholes and waited for the signal to attack. Russian shrapnel sprayed the newly arrived. Human debris collected quickly. Medics loaded the wounded into ambulances, which raced toward field hospitals located safely in the rear. Trucks, tanks, and motorcycles pulled to the roadside to let the meat wagons pass, while inside, attendants bent over mutilated bodies strapped tightly onto stretchers. At the field hospitals, the atmosphere was almost tranquil. Only the grave diggers disturbed the hushed quiet as, behind the hospital tents, they methodically lowered one coffin after another into the ground. Army chaplains intoned appropriate prayers, then an honor guard fired quick volleys into the air. Moments later, a team of men began hammering wooden crosses into the ground at the head of each grave, marking by name, rank, and unit, the soldier who was now buried beneath foreign soil. A passing courier noticed that groups of cemeteries were spreading across the steppe like clumps of wild mushrooms. 3 miles from the front, a battery of 150-millimeter Nebelwerfers, those fearsomely squat, six-barreled mortars mounted on rubber-tired gun carriages, was strangely silent. Throughout the morning, as the gun crews huddled in slit trenches to escape the terrible backblast of their weapons, the mortars had spat series of 78-pound high-explosive shells toward an unseen foe. Now out of ammunition, the men were relaxing and their commander, Lieutenant Emil Metzger, squatted in the shade of a truck. Taking a pad of paper from his jacket pocket, he began to scribble a message to his wife in Frankfurt. Liebe Käthe. How could he break the news that he had decided to give up his first furlough in 2 years so that one of his friends could go home in his place and get married? As he pondered the question, Emil paused to rub the stubble of his 3-day-old beard. He was proud of what he had accomplished since that day back in 1933 when he had first joined the fledgling Reichswehr for a 12-year hitch, because he wanted to do something for the fatherland. During the invasion of Poland in 1939, Metzger's aggressiveness, his gymnast's quickness and ability to withstand physical hardship, had earned him promotion to sergeant. The next year, he and his men had fought across France and were hardened by the horrors they saw on the roads surrounding Dunkirk. He now wore the Iron Cross Second Class and was an officer. It was a far cry from the apprenticeship that he had been supposed to serve while learning the career of Master Butcher. Patriotism had not been his only reason for joining the army. His other reason for enlisting was that he was sickened by the killing of animals. Emil wondered if he should confide in his letter that his curly black hair was suddenly touched with gray. His brown eyes crinkled at the corners as he recalled the dance at which he had met Käthe Bausch. They had married shortly afterward, in a brief span of time between fighting in 1940, and they had spent only 4 nights together before he had gone off again to battle. It was difficult to find the proper, soothing words to explain why he was not coming home, but he was sure Käthe would understand. There was no reason for her to worry. According to the latest rumors, the war was nearly over. The Soviet army had been routed. One more battle should end the killing. In closing, he said, "I should be home for Christmas." He sealed the letter and handed it to an orderly to mail, just as the supply truck pulled up with a fresh stock of shells. Tying a handkerchief across his nose and mouth, the lieutenant ordered the battery to join the line of march. They were headed, Emil had been told, for a place on the Volga River called Stalingrad. Other men shared Emil Metzger's optimism. At 6th Army Field Headquarters, 30 miles west of the Fluid Front, officers read maps and mentally subtracted 2 more armies from the Russian order of battle. It was obvious that when the German tanks linked up, the last escape route to the Don would close, and the rabble trapped within the pincers would cease to exist. Now what concerned the strategists was the plotting for the next phase of the offensive, fording the Don and moving 40 miles further east to the Volga. The original plans for Operation Blue did not call for the capture of Stalingrad. In fact, the city was not even a primary target for attack. As originally conceived, the strike force was to consist of 2 groups of armies, A and B. Army Group A, under the command of Field Marshal List, included the 17th and 1st Panzer Armies. Army Group B, under Fedor von Bock, boasted the 4th Panzer and 6th Armies, which were to be aided by the Hungarians in support of their rear echelons. The army groups were to move eastward on a broad front to the line of the Volga River in the area of the city of Stalingrad. After neutralizing Russian war production in that region by bombing and artillery fire, and after cutting the vital transportation line on the Volga, both army groups were to turn south and drive on the oil fields of the Caucasus. But in July, the Führer himself had subtly altered the scope of the campaign after German intelligence reported that the Russians had few reliable divisions on the west bank of the Volga. Boat traffic on the river had not increased, which indicated that the Soviet high command was not yet pouring reinforcements into the city from the Urals or Siberia. Furthermore, the Armed Forces High Command, OKW, determined that the defense lines between the Don and Volga were primitive at best, though it appeared that some Russian work battalions were out on the steppe, throwing up hasty anti-tank fortifications. Thus, Hitler concluded, the Red Army was not about to make a major stand at Stalingrad, and he ordered 6th Army to seize the city by force as soon as possible. In his cramped, field-gray tent, the commander of the 6th Army, Colonel General Friedrich von Paulus, was rejoicing quietly. A cautious man who disdained public emotion, he relaxed for a few moments by listening to Beethoven on a gramophone. Music was the best catalyst for his moody, introspective personality. Tall and darkly handsome, the 52-year-old general was the classic example of a German general staff officer. Apolitical, trained only to do his job in the army, he left diplomacy to the party in power. He thought Adolf Hitler an excellent leader for the German people, a man who had contributed greatly to the development of the state. After watching him evolve the strategies that conquered Poland, France, and most of Europe, Paulus was awed by Hitler's grasp of the technical aspects of warfare. He considered him a genius. His wife did not share his beliefs. The former Elena Constance Rossetti Solescu, Coca to her friends, a descendant of one of Romania's royal houses, had married Paulus in 1912 and borne him a daughter and twin sons. Both boys now served in the army. She detested the Nazi regime and told her husband he was far too good for the likes of men such as Keitel and the other lackeys who surrounded Hitler. When Germany attacked Poland, she vehemently condemned it as an unjust act. Paulus did not agree with her. Content with his role, he merely carried out orders. When, in the fall of 1940, he brought home maps and other memoranda related to the planned invasion of Russia, Coca found them and confronted Paulus, saying a war against the Soviet Union was completely unjustified. He tried to avoid discussing the matter with her, but she persisted. "What will become of us all? Who will survive to the end?" she asked. Attempting to calm her fears, Paulus had said the war with Russia would be over in about 6 weeks' time. She was not appeased. Just as she had feared, the new campaign dragged on past the six-week deadline and into the awful winter of 1941 on the Moscow front. Yet despite the setbacks, despite the horrendous losses suffered by the German army because of the climate and ferocious Russian resistance, Paulus retained one unshakable belief. Hitler was invincible. In January 1942, when his superior, Field Marshal Reichenau, died suddenly, Paulus finally got his life's desire, command of an army in the field. The two men could not have been more dissimilar. Reichenau, an ardent Nazi, had been coarse in manner and unkempt in appearance. Paulus was impeccably groomed at all times. He even wore gloves in the field because he abhorred dirt. He bathed and changed his uniforms twice a day. Despite such glaring differences, Paulus had sublimated his retiring manner to the volatile Reichenau. A master of detail, fascinated with figures and grand strategy, he handled the administration of the 6th Army while Reichenau led charges at the front. In return, Reichenau treated Paulus like a son and always trusted his judgment. The two men agreed on all but one important policy. It marked the great gulf between them in heritage and philosophy. Reichenau had been a ruthless believer in Hitler's thesis of racial supremacy and had supported the Führer's infamous Commissar Order, which ordained the killing of all captured Russian political officers without benefit of trial. He even went a step further by introducing within 6th Army Command what came to be known as the Severity Order. It read in part, "The most important objective of this campaign against the Jewish Bolshevik system is the complete destruction of its sources of power and the extermination of the Asiatic influence in European civilization. In this Eastern theater, the soldier is not only a man fighting in accordance with the rules of the art of war, but also the ruthless standard-bearer of a national conception. For this reason, the soldier must learn fully to appreciate the necessity for the severe but just retribution that must be meted out to the subhuman species of Jewry." Reichenau's insistence on retribution had resulted in monstrous crimes. After the frontline troops of 6th Army divisions passed through towns, a motley collection of homicidal maniacs came in their wake and systematically tried to eliminate the Jewish population. Divided into four Einsatzgruppen, special extermination squads, across Russia. They numbered approximately 3,000 sadists, who had been recruited mostly from the ranks of Himmler's police forces, the Schutzstaffeln, or SS, Elite Guard, and Sicherheitsdienst, or SD, Security Service. Others wandered in from punishment battalions and psychiatric hospitals. At a training center in Saxony, they had been taught to use the rifle and machine pistol and told explicitly what to do with them in the Soviet Union. Dressed in black uniforms, they traveled by truck convoy, and terrified villagers soon referred to them as the Black Crows. Reichenau had helped the Einsatzgruppen as much as he could. Anxious to conserve ammunition, he even suggested each Jew be finished off with no more than 2 bullets. The mass killings affected the attitude of many Sixth Army soldiers who witnessed the Black Crows at work. Given free rein by their commanders, they enthusiastically helped exterminate the Jewish population. At times, soldiers in bathing suits and other casual off-duty attire snapped photographs of executions and sent them home to families and friends. A picnic atmosphere prevailed around ditches filled with bodies. Those Germans who had protested the killings were ignored. Nothing interfered with the campaign of extermination. Nearly 1 million people died before Friedrich von Paulus assumed control and ended the genocide, at least in his sector, by rescinding both the Commissar and Severity orders. As commander of the Sixth Army, Paulus was victorious in his first major battle when, in May, the Russians had tried to upset German plans at Kharkov by attacking first. The Sixth Army was instrumental in rallying the Wehrmacht from near disaster and trapping more than 200,000 Russians in a giant envelopment. Congratulations poured in from old comrades, some of whom now assiduously courted his favor. It was clear to them that he was marked for greater responsibilities within the German Army's high command. Later, when Operation Blue appeared to be sweeping the Russians away like chaff in the wind, Paulus's career expectations assumed even more gigantic proportions. Still fastidious, always the epitome of the cool, thinking machine, he traveled the barren steppe, seeking a last confrontation with the enemy. An excellent cadre of staff officers made the task of running Sixth Army immeasurably easier. The chief of staff, General Arthur Schmidt, was new, but like Paulus, he was a master of the smallest detail and promised to take much of that tedious workload upon himself. A thin-faced man with bulging eyes and a sharply pointed chin, Schmidt did not fit the traditional mold for German staff officers. Born in Hamburg to a merchant family, he had served in World War I as a soldier. Afterward, he stayed through the convulsions of post-war politics and emerged as an officer under Hitler's reborn Reichswehr. He was autocratic, overbearing, and had a nasty habit of interrupting conversations when the subject bored him. Many officers disliked his imperious manner. Some resented his rapid rise in rank and responsibility, but as he assumed his job under Paulus, Schmidt ignored his critics. Sharply different in temperament and tastes, the two men thought alike on military matters. As a result, the Sixth Army was functioning like a smoothly running watch. Then there were the field commanders, including such men as General Walter Heitz, head of the Eighth Corps, a bull who had been in charge of the funeral procession for Chancellor Hindenburg, and now was a veteran professional who enjoyed soldiering and fox hunting. Walter Seidlitz Kurzbach of the 51st Corps, the infantry arm of the army, was the stubborn, white-haired scion of a noble family in Prussia, a highly competent tactician, and only the 54th German to earn the coveted oak leaves to the knighthood of the Iron Cross. Edler von Daniel, a hard-drinking womanizer, had been brought from peaceful occupation duty in Normandy to lead the 295th Division. Hans Huber, a severely wounded veteran of World War I, and the only one-armed general in the German army, had persevered to become commander of the famous 16th Panzer Division, now hurrying to forge a link around the Russians at the Don. Huber was known as Der Mensch, the man, to his troops. Thus, 6th Army was a model of military brilliance, and in his camper, Friedrich von Paulus reflected on the good fortunes of past weeks and wrote an effusive letter to a friend in Germany. We've advanced quite a bit and have left Kharkov 500 kilometers behind us. The great thing now is to hit the Russian so hard a crack that he won't recover for a very long time. In his enthusiasm, Paulus neglected to mention several nagging concerns. The dysentery he had first picked up in the Balkans during World War I was plaguing him, and on the strategy level, his left flank was worrisome. There, well to the north along the line of the tortuous Upper Don, the armies of the satellite nations, Hungary, Italy, and Romania, were struggling to hold the left flank while Sixth Army moved east. He was relying heavily on the strength of these puppet forces to blunt any enemy attack coming from that direction. The armies Paulus worried about were moving slowly. Farthest toward the northwest, soldiers of the Hungarian Second Army had begun to dig in along the Upper Don. To their right, men of the Italian Eighth Army were preparing to occupy a long stretch of looping river line running toward the east. The Italians not only had been given the job of containing any Russian threat from across the river, they also served as a buffer between the Hungarians and the Romanian Third Army, was to hold the territory from Serafimovich to Kletskaya deep in the steppe. The German High Command had inserted the Italians between the other two armies to avoid conflict between ancient enemies, who might forget the Russians and go at each other's throats. That rivalry was hardly an auspicious omen. It underlined the Germans' desperate manpower situation, for the three satellite armies had been brought together in a haphazard manner. The Hungarian and Romanian forces were staffed mostly by political officers who were unschooled in warfare. Both armies were riddled by corruption and inefficiency. The lowly soldier had it worst of all. Poorly led and poorly fed, he endured outrageous privations. Officers whipped enlisted men on the merest whim. When action got dangerous, many officers simply went home. One private wrote his family that even his priest had deserted in a moment of crisis. Worse, they were equipped with antiquated weapons. Anti-tank guns were almost non-existent. Rifles were of World War I vintage. Many similar conditions prevailed in the Italian army. Dragooned into service far from their homeland, wary of the bond between Hitler's Nazi Germany and Mussolini's fascist state, the troopers grumbled unhappily as they marched through shattered Russian towns and villages. These men had not come on any crusade for Lebensraum, space for living. They moved toward the Don because Benito Mussolini bargained for Hitler's favor with the bodies of his soldiers. The Italians had sent their best units into the Soviet Union. Proud military names such as the Giulia, Bersaglieri, Corsaria, Torino, Alpini graced the shoulder patches of troops struggling through the enervating heat. Their fathers had fought along the Piave and Isonzo rivers against the Austrians during World War I, and Ernest Hemingway immortalized their battles in A Farewell to Arms. Some of the Italian soldiers questioned the reasons they were fighting for the Nazi cause. At a railroad siding in Warsaw, 21-year-old Lieutenant Vignero Marsan had seen its harsh realities for the first time. From a train window, he watched a long line of civilians passing by. Apathetic, forlorn, each wore the yellow star of David. Then Marsan saw the cruel-faced guards with guns, cocked and ready to fire. A chill rippled along his spine, and long after his train had rocked on into Russia, he brooded about what he had witnessed. For other Italians, the expedition into the steppe had different connotations. Crack Alpini soldiers guided mules along and kept their mountain climbing gear under canvas. The nearest mountains were in the Caucasus, far to the south, and Hitler had decided to conquer them without the Italians. Shaking their heads in amazement, the elite Alpini trudged along the flat plains, wondering why they were in Russia at all. But 27-year-old Lieutenant Felice Bracci was delighted with the great adventure. He had always wanted to explore the steppe country of Russia, to gaze on its timeless beauty. A recent university graduate, Bracci joined the Young Fascist League and went from there directly into Mussolini's army. In his first battles in Albania, he was wounded and decorated for defending an outpost. When offered the choice of going to Libya or Russia, the decision was difficult to make. He wanted desperately to see the pyramids. Finally choosing the steppe, he now led a company of men eastward to the Don. Dr. Cristoforo Capone did not share Bracci's cultural interests, but that mattered little. He, too, was pleased to be part of the Russian expedition. The seventh of nine children, he was the rogue in his family. Constantly good-humored, he delighted everyone who met him. In his division, the Torino, The prankster was easily the most popular man among soldiers trying to conquer homesickness. When the news came of the birth of his first daughter, Capone got permission for a month's leave. With a last joke and a smile, the happy doctor waved goodbye to his friends and left the line of march for a reunion in Salerno. He hoped to be back in time for the finish of the walkover campaign. In the meantime, his comrades plunged doggedly ahead, dragging their antiquated cannon and rifles, singing songs of Sorrento and the sunlight. On their hats, they wore bright green and red cockades. In their hearts, they longed for home. Chapter 2. Deep in a Ukrainian pine forest, outside the town of Vinnytsia, and 500 miles west of the German troops near the Don, on the same morning that Friedrich von Paulus wrote glowingly of the future to a friend, Adolf Hitler climbed the steps of a log cabin and swept into a starkly furnished conference room. Seating himself on an iron chair at the head of a map table, with his back to a window, he listened carefully to the latest intelligence reports as they were explained by his chief of staff, the bespectacled, trimly mustachioed General Franz Halder. The meticulous Halder had no love for the man he served. He acted deferentially toward his Führer and accepted frequent tirades with the calm of one resigned to his fate. Before and during the war, Halder had schemed with other officers to overthrow Hitler and replace him with a monarchy. The dissident group was too timid and vacillating to initiate the coup, however, and watched passively as the German army scored triumph after triumph under Hitler's almost mystical leadership. By the summer of 1942, Halder was a captive in thrall to a despot. For weeks, though, he had reminded Hitler that the signs of Russian disintegration were illusory, that the enemy was not kaput. Halder believed that the campaign in the previous winter had bled Germany white. The equivalent of 80 divisions, nearly 800,000 men, were buried beneath the soil of Russia. Despite carefully doctored tables of strength, the majority of the German divisions were 50% under strength. And while more than a million besieged Russian civilians had starved to death during the nightmarish winter of 1941, Leningrad still clung to life. Moscow also remained as the nerve center of the Soviet state. Of more significance, the oil fields in the Caucasus pumped life-giving petroleum products to the Soviet war machine. As a result, Hitler had become obsessed with the importance of petroleum products to a mechanized state, and he had devised Operation Blue expressly to strangle Russia's oil production, and thereby her potential to wage modern war. To promote the offensive, he had flown to Poltava on June 1st, and, surrounded by deputies such as Paulus, he put on a brilliant oratorical display that mesmerized everyone. Predictably, the generals failed to make any rebuttal to his proposal, which completely ignored German shortages in manpower and equipment, and concentrated only on the abysmal state of the Red Army. Thus, Operation Blue had begun when the 4th Panzer Army struck on June 28th, due east toward the rail junction of Voronezh. 2 days later, Paulus's 6th Army followed suit, covering the 4th Army's right flank and engaging Russian forces pulling back in disorder. Almost immediately, the 4th Army ran into difficulties. Originally, Hitler planned to bypass Voronezh in hopes of trapping the Soviet armies on the open plains. But when German armor easily penetrated the outskirts and commanders radioed for permission to seize the rest of the city, Hitler vacillated, leaving the decision to Army Group B's commander, Field Marshal Fedor von Bock. Amazed at being given a choice, Bock hesitated briefly, then sent 2 tank divisions into Voronezh. The Russians had rushed in reinforcements, quickly pinning the Germans down in savage street fighting, and soldiers in the 4th Army soon referred to Voronezh as a cursed town. Meanwhile, Hitler raged. The main Russian armies were slipping away, down a long corridor to the southeast between the Don and Donets rivers. Hitler demanded that Bock catch the Russians. The marshal tried, but the Russians withdrew rapidly, taking most of their trucks and tanks with them. To General Halder, this successful withdrawal was ominous. It meant the Soviet high command still was retreating according to plan. But once again, when he told Hitler his fears, the Führer laughed aloud. Arrogant in his belief that the Russians were reeling, confused, and ripe for slaughter, the Führer began to tinker with the delicate balance of his own forces. He separated the army groups, sending Group A off at a right angle into the Caucasus, while Group B drove straight ahead across the steppe toward Stalingrad. Worse, Hitler stripped the 4th Panzer Army from Group B and attached it to the Caucasus operation. That left Paulus's 6th Army alone, driving on into the hostile depths of the Soviet Union. By his action, Hitler had weakened each army group and left them vulnerable to Soviet counterstrokes. The move also caused consternation within German Army headquarters. Halder could not believe the Führer would commit such a blunder. Stunned, he went to his quarters and poured his agonized feelings into his diary. The chronic tendency to underrate enemy capabilities is gradually assuming grotesque proportions. Serious work is becoming impossible here. This so-called leadership is characterized by a pathological reacting to the impressions of the moment. When Hitler pivoted an entire army across another's path, he had defied the military maxim that any interference with the delicate internal functions of a massed body of troops frequently leads to chaos. And on the steppe roads of Russia, the 6th Army stopped dead, while swarms of vehicles and men from the 4th Panzer Army cut left to right across its line of advance. Enormous traffic jams developed. Tanks of one army mingled with those of the other. Supply trucks got lost in a maze of contradictory signposts and directions handed out by irate military policemen. Worse, the 4th Army took the bulk of the oil and gasoline meant to fuel both armies. By the time the last 4th Army tank had disappeared to the south, Paulus was commanding a stalled war machine. His supply lines were tangled, his tanks were without fuel, and he watched impotently as Russian rear guards vanished into the eastern haze. Furious at the delay, he began to wonder openly whether the enemy might now have enough time to organize a formidable defense line beyond the horizon. Only Hitler remained unruffled. He scoffed when Halder showed him an intelligence estimate of more than 1 million Russian reserves still uncommitted behind the Volga. Jubilant at the easy capture of Rostov, the gateway city to the Caucasus, on July 23rd, he executed another series of orders which reflected his growing confidence in an early victory. He transferred Field Marshal Erich von Manstein and his 5 divisions from the Crimea north to Leningrad, at the very time their strength was needed to guarantee success in the oil fields. He also uprooted 2 elite panzer divisions, the Leibstandarte and Grossdeutschland, from southern Russia and sent them off to France because he was suddenly fearful of an Allied invasion from across the English Channel. Again, the bewildered Halder tried to instill a note of caution. At another briefing, he pushed a worn map across the table and dryly explained that it showed where the Red Army had defeated Denikin's White Army in the Russian Civil War of 1920. Halder ran his fingers along the line of the Volga near the old city of Tsaritsyn. The architect of the victory, he added, had been Joseph Stalin, and the city was now called Stalingrad. Temporarily sobered by Halder's obvious reference to the possibility of history repeating itself, Hitler had promised to keep a close watch on the progress of the 6th Army and to pay particular attention to its flanks. In the last days of July, he moved swiftly to strengthen 6th Army's exposed position on the steppe. Completely reversing himself, he told the 4th Panzer Army to turn around again and rejoin the drive to the Volga. Rushing toward the Caucasus, the 4th Army's panzers suddenly stopped dead and turned northeast. So many precious days have been lost, General Halder fumed in his quarters. But at least he was happy that Paulus now had a friendly army coming up on his right flank. Perhaps, thought Halder, the delay had not given the Russians the grace period they needed. By the evening of August 5th, intelligence pouring into Vinnytsia tended to sustain that hope. Halder briefed Hitler that 6th Army's pincers were about to close on 2 enemy armies, and the 4th Panzer Army confirmed the capture of Katynakova, a key rail center just 73 miles southwest of Stalingrad. Barring any unforeseen obstacles, 4th Army anticipated a quick thrust to the Volga. At dinner that night, Adolf Hitler gloated over the situation. His strategy had been vindicated. He told everyone that the Soviet Union was about to collapse. Chapter 3. While Hitler spoke of triumph, the streets of Moscow were totally dark. But behind drawn curtains in his Kremlin office, the premier of all the Russias, Joseph Stalin, was following his normal work schedule, which began in late afternoon and ended near dawn. The lynx-eyed Stalin had pursued this timetable for years, and from these sessions had come orders that brought terror to his people and subversion to nations around the world. He was a tyrant who once had studied for the priesthood, a revolutionary who robbed banks to support the Bolshevist cause, a glutton and a near drunkard. Upon the death of Lenin, he assumed total control of the Soviet Union. Those who served him endured his rages in silence. Those who crossed him died violently. Stalin never forgot or forgave. He once told a Russian writer that Ivan the Terrible had not been ruthless enough because he left too many enemies alive. Stalin did not make the same error. Nearly 20 years after he broke with Leon Trotsky, one of his agents penetrated the exiled dissenter's security screen in Mexico and drove an alpenstock through his skull. From Stalin's office, emissaries emerged to slay thousands of Red Army officers in the 1937 to 1938 purges. It was on his orders that more than 10 million kulaks, farmers and landowners who balked at turning over their properties to the new communist state, were killed. And it was from this apartment that the directive went out to sign the Nazi-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact in August 1939, which Stalin believed gave him time to prepare for the inevitable war with Germany. In this decision, Stalin had trusted an equally cynical dictator, even when spies like Richard Sorge and a man called Lucy told him the exact date Germany proposed to attack the Soviet Union. Branding the information provided by these agents as a part of a British plot to draw Russia into war, Stalin put his faith in Hitler's word. It had been a colossal blunder. The Nazi invasion brought the Soviet Union to the brink of disaster, and Stalin went into shock. 10 days passed before he rallied enough to resume command of his shattered armies, and it was none too soon. By October 1941, Hitler had swallowed most of European Russia. In December, now only 7 miles from Moscow, German scouts trained their binoculars on the turrets of the Kremlin. But the Russians held, and the crisis eased. Stalin regained his equilibrium and learned from past mistakes. When the spies who had warned him about Hitler's plans for invasion continued to send a torrent of vital information to Moscow, he paid closer attention. Operating out of Paris was Leonard Trepper, called the Big Chief, who ran a spy network known to German secret police as the Red Orchestra, because of